Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. 150 years ago, on June the 9th, 1870, Charles Dickens died prematurely at the age of 58. He left behind not only his wonderful works of fiction, but also a wealth of writings about his work, his thoughts, his personal history. Well, this has now been painstakingly pieced together to produce Charles Dickens' My Life, which brings us his story in a compelling first-person narrative. My guest is not actually Dickens, though in these unprecedented times I wouldn't be surprised. We won't hear Dickens' voice in the interview, but we do hear his voice in the book, echoing down the years to us in this work by a former barrister who spent the best part of 15 years researching 15,000 sources of information, everything from letters to articles to speeches, and uncovered previously unknown facts about the great British author. Derwin Hope, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Georgina. It's nice to be here.
Where and how did your own life and that of Dickens coincide?
Eventually in 2004, although before that I'd started thinking and researching about him because I heard that he'd had a secret life and I wanted to find out all about it. I love biographies, I like knowing about people's life stories, and that just fascinated me, so that set me going.
This fascination with people's life stories really comes from your work previously, doesn't it? Tell us a little about that.
Well, I became a barrister eventually and trained as a barrister and doing a lot of criminal law, so you were dealing with people's life stories, and then eventually I became a judge and completely by chance, I was posted to Portsmouth, which is Dickens's birthplace. And that's when it all changed, really. That was 2004.
And I suppose being a judge, you must have heard many, many life stories, mostly with unhappy endings.
Yes. Every day of my life, basically, you were hearing life stories that went wrong most of the time and trying to sort it all out and do the best you can for people.
So, you're posted to Portsmouth and you realise that Charles Dickens was born there. This is now 2004. So, tell us what happened next.
Well, the first thing I did, having had an interest in him for about 10 years, I suppose, before that, I went to his birthplace. It's a little house in Portsmouth that's kept as a small museum by the city now. Very humble little place. And I went there and I stood in the bedroom where he was born. And it went through my head, how did he get from here, this humble sort of beginning, to the life of fame and wealth and whatever he had later on in life? And did he, at any stage, explain all that and how it happened in his own words? And that's what really set me researching in depth about him and concentrating on what he had said about his life story.
So tell us about the process then of putting the book together, because although he wrote reams and reams, he never actually wrote his own life story. I think he meant to, but his early death perhaps meant that didn't happen.
That's correct. He expressed a wish several times to write his own life story. In fact, shortly before he wrote David Copperfield was one of the times he said that he was thinking about writing his own life story. He wanted to leave this legacy for his children mainly. And several times he kept saying, but because he died when he was only 58, he hadn't got round to doing it. And it was just an enormous task to piece it all together. But I was determined to do it. And I found, of course, that there were these 15,000 letters in which he not only explained what he was doing in his life, but on many occasions put his innermost thoughts into these letters. And it was fascinating to read it. And you basically went along with him in his life and went in his footsteps and you could see how his thinking was going. And I, from all of that, got the view that I could actually piece together what he said, not what I said or anybody else had said, about his life and write his life story as the nearest to an autobiography as I could possibly manage.
Now, he had ordered letters to and from him to be destroyed. So I wonder how difficult it was to find this material.
Well, a team of people have spent 50 years of their existence after the war putting all together these 15,000 letters. They're called the Pilgrim Edition and they're published by Oxford University Press. And they're an amazing piece of work. It's just incredible to go through it all. It's all done chronologically. Letters, of course, are still coming out of the woodwork even now. But they managed to get 12 volumes of this together, of these 15,000 letters. And I read them all in detail, all the way through, and flagged up anything in them that might be part of his life and his own thoughts on his position. So, and then I went back over them and picked the pieces out. It was just like picking up pieces of jigsaw puzzle and then eventually having to put them all together. Whenever he was writing something for his magazines, for instance, I found out that if he was a bit short of time, he would actually scrawl something down that was part of his life from an earlier time, particularly his childhood. He wrote quite a lot about that. And he also wrote, of course, to Forster, his great friend, about the time he spent in the blacking factory.
Did you find much that had never been published before?
Yes and no. Some of it has been published, of course, but I found little snippets of things that really hit me when I read them. For instance, about his youth and how poor he became. He when he was born, his father was not very well off, but he squandered all his money. And when Dickens, at the age of 12, had to basically fend for himself when his father was arrested and taken off to the debtor's prison, he was left on his own. And there were many times when he didn't have any money at all, and nor food. And I found a little note, for instance, saying that when he didn't have any food, he used to go into Covent Garden Market and stare at the pineapples, which was an extraordinary thing, because that probably made it even worse. But that was his juvenile way of trying to get some food into his tummy.
As you said, I mean, you stood in his birthplace wondering how he got from those extremes of poverty to the heights which he reached. What do you think it was that drove him?
It was ambition, but I think more than anything, the wish not to go through what his father had put him through. And ending up in the Marshalsea prison for debt. He was obsessed with debt. Later on, with his children, he kept on and on at them, don't get into debt, don't get into debt. And that's, I think, the driving force for what he did. But he was determined as well to get on and change his whole lifestyle. I mean, when he was 15, his parents put him into a legal office as a basically an errand boy, and he hated the whole thing and wanted to get out of it. And he made monumental efforts to do that, mainly by learning shorthand writing so that he could become a journalist.
And you write about that he writes about that, I should say, talking about how fiendishly difficult he found it. It was like learning six languages all at once, he said.
Yeah. All these spider webs and things that he had to learn, and he nearly drove him mad. But he kept at it and he did it, and he became one of the finest shorthand writers in the world.
Now, he didn't chronicle everything. How did you get an insight into the bits of his life that he didn't write about?
He wrote about most of the things. Later on, of course, he was very coy about his secret life. But there's been a lot of research. People have found his diary. I in fact, went to New York and got his diary out of the library where it's kept. I had a good look at it, and you can see it online as well. And if you can decode it, which somebody has done, you can see exactly what he was doing. So there are all sorts of ways of which you can find out about what he did. And you can also, of course, read contemporary reports of what he did. His manager, his reading manager, for instance, who went round with him, said how he reacted to things. His family reported things that he'd said and did. So it was all a combination of things, really, and putting it all together to make sure that it fitted into a narrative.
Well, now, tell us about his secret life.
Well, he was 45. He was in a loveless marriage, which was very sad. It's fascinating, actually, to read his story about all that when he writing to his friend Forster. That was something that I had never understood before. I read his letters about how he said that all happened. And then his old girlfriend, Maria Beadnell came back on the scene, who'd been somebody he'd gone out with for 4 years and fell in love with when he was younger. She turned out to be somebody completely different when he saw her again, and he was devastated at that. And then he met Nellie Ternan completely by chance. She was 18, he was 45, she was 18, and he completely fell head over heels in love with her, hopelessly in love. She didn't necessarily feel the same way, but she was flattered because she was living in poverty, basically, with her mother and her two sisters. They were sort of jobbing actresses, and he took them on, basically, and changed their life for them.
And is this what he refers to as the period of his life when he's seized with lunacy?
Yes, that's exactly it. He followed them when they went on a theatre trip up to Doncaster, and that's when he described himself as being seized with lunacy.
Do you feel that you got inside his brain? Do you think you can think like he thought?
Yes, I think I can. It's not easy to say because he was such a complex person, but I could see how he reacted to certain things that happened. And it was all terribly sad about his separation, because he wanted a very straightforward separation. He wanted to be nice to his wife. He wanted to be generous to her. And he was going to be. He set it all up. And then his mother-in-law and a sister of his wife made some pretty vile accusations about him, and he absolutely exploded and said things that perhaps he would not have done in a normal situation. And he just didn't want anything more to do with any of them, which included his wife, and that's how it all happened. But it wasn't his intention to do that at all.
I mean, he seemed to have rather an odd relationship with his sister-in-law.
Yes, I think that was quite a lot to do with her, to be honest. She met him, Georgie, this is, when she was 7. He, at that stage, was visiting the family house, and he got on really well with the whole family. And it was, I think, Mary, probably the middle sister, between Georgina and his wife, Kate, who he really mentally clicked with. But, of course, she died when she was 17 in his arms. And by that stage, he'd married Kate. And I think it wasn't long into the relationship before he realised that he'd probably made a big mistake. He said that he realised it finally after the birth of his second child, Mary.
The book includes his two momentous visits to America and his opinions of the institutions and the situations that he found there. Can you give us more detail on that?
Well, I was amazed when I read this about it. I read American Notes, of course, which was what he wrote about it all as his travelogue, basically, after the event that got him to a bit of trouble. But he didn't tell the full story in American Notes, and I found that through the letters that he was writing at the same time, sending them back home, particularly about the international copyright business. But he was mobbed. It was called Bosmania when he went over there. I didn't realise the full extent of it before I read it all. He was absolutely in the height of his powers. He just published The Old Curiosity Shop, and the Americans had taken to that like nobody's business. And when he landed, both in Boston and in New York on his voyage, all the reporters jumped on his boat. And in New York, they tore the coat to pieces that he was wearing. He was rather miffed about that because it was rather an expensive coat he'd bought in Regent Street. But the people just absolutely flocked him from all over the States when he got there. It was like, as I say, the Beatles all rolled into one. And he had that sort of reception there. It was incredible. He's stayed there 6 months for the first time he went. And he travelled quite extensively, as you've probably seen from the book, all around the eastern part of the States and well into the middle part of right up to the prairies.
Reading his fiction alongside reading about his life in his own words, can you sort of follow his inspirations and see the parallels that were happening?
Oh, yes, very much so. This is one of the reasons why I was doing it as well. And I was reading the fiction as I went along as well. And you could see very much the parallels and how it came to be. I mean, particularly Oliver Twist and then Nicholas Nickleby and so on. You could see how it all developed and how his thinking was going when he was doing that. I mean, Oliver Twist, I think, is one of the best books ever written because on the face of it, a simple children's story. And a lot of people think that's just what it is. That's all it is. But in fact, it was a very deep political treaty on workhouses because he had been in Parliament when the Act had gone through and people were debating the Act to put these workhouses into position. And he thought this was completely wrong. And this was his way of making a protest about workhouses. And of course, it's lasted the time because even now we talk about workhouses in this derogatory way that he had. But that was the reasoning behind him writing Oliver Twist.
And do you think that he might have been tempted to be a politician to effect radical change through direct action rather than through his work?
Well, he was asked many times to become an MP and he turned it all down. And I think that reverted back to the time when he was a reporter in the House of Commons. And he didn't think much of politicians at all in the main. And one or two that he was impressed by, but virtually hardly any of them. And he ended up calling Parliament the great dust heap of Westminster. He didn't think much of them at all. And every time he was asked to be a politician and an MP, he turned it down.
Tell us about his later years. Did he have any sense of his impending death?
No, I don't think so, although he just put it to one side. He was quite ill for quite a long time, but he was basically a workaholic. He just never stopped. And he would never take no for an answer if he was feeling unwell. He would soldier on. He was an incredible character in that way. And I think it just broke him in the end. If you look at the pictures of him from when he was writing Nickleby, he was quite an amazingly smart man. But when you look at the later pictures and the photographs of him, he's worn out. And he's only 58 when he died, you'd think when you look at the pictures, he's about 88.
Mm. Having this insight into the way that he thought, how do you think he would have reacted to the world today?
I think he'd have been very critical of it. He was critical. Anything that he saw that he didn't like and he felt was not going to the general good, he would criticise. And wherever it was, this is why the Americans actually were up in arms, or at least some of them, because he criticised when he went over there everything that he saw that was wrong. Slavery in particular, he absolutely hated slavery. He didn't like them spitting either. He made pretty cogent comments about that. Prison reform, he went to a prison in America. He toured many prisons all over the place. And he didn't like the way that the prisoners were being treated, shut up in their cells. Anything that he didn't like, he was swift to comment upon and give his opinion. And I'm sure he would have done today if that had been the case. He would have been foremost in his criticisms of the way most politicians behave.
Derwin, thank you very much indeed. Charles Dickens' My Life is edited by Derwin Hope. It's published by Clink Street Publishing and it's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hole and Charlie Filmer-Court. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening. Thank you.